right. So the first question I would ask, it may sound a bit simple because it is, but I think it's pretty rich in what the answers could be. And that is, what is race? How would you define it as a philosopher?
Races are natural kinds. I believe that there are natural kinds in the world. I'm a metaphysical realist. I think there's an external world, and the external world comes divided up into different kinds of things. Races are subspecies of the broader human race, and they are best described as inbred populations of the larger race that have undergone divergent evolution in particular environments and therefore have come to have certain distinct characteristics that are evenly distributed throughout the group. So if a population of our ancestors became isolated in a particular environment, they might, under certain circumstances, have new traits emerge that are selected for, and because the population breeds with one another, these traits would become uniform throughout the population. So it's an inbred subgroup of a larger race. That's how it forms. And it has certain distinct characteristics that are distributed throughout it. And given enough time, enough divergent evolution, these different races can become entirely different species in the sense that they can't really breed with or even communicate with or live alongside with other kin, basically, you know, that have diverged from them evolutionarily speaking. So that's how I think of race. I think of race as a natural kind that has emerged through divergent evolution. And as divergent evolution continues to diverge and ramify, you don't just get different races of groups, but you get radically different groups. And so there was a time when human beings and lobsters diverged from in the great tree of evolution. And I think that obviously we don't get along too well together. We can't have amicable human lobster societies and things like that. If we spend too much time around them, they end up in pots of boiling water and so forth.
Right. Well, that's very clear. You actually cleared up quite a few questions that I had on that. But you say divergent evolution, natural kinds. So let's imagine that we have a white ethnostate now, right? And let's just assume for the sake of argument that it's a single white ethnostate, so we don't have to get bogged down in like German ethnostates and all that. So would it be conceivable in such a situation that eventually, you know, a few thousand years down the line, you would have a divergent evolution among white people such that they can't live side by side, these new groups?
Yes, and in fact, we have examples of that, because not only is evolution for human beings biological, it's also cultural. We have layered on top of biological evolution, cultural evolution. Culture is a new way that we can grapple with the world, basically. And it undergoes selection pressures in the same way that biological traits do. And it's much more replicable, in a sense. Ideas can spread much more quickly than genes. So, you know, for instance, ideas can spread through a society very quickly, whereas genes might take generations and generations to be spread equally through a group and make it, you know, sort of uniform in a particular genetic trait. And we do know, for instance, that even white groups that are genetically very, very similar, but who have diverged in terms of their cultural evolution, can not get along very well with one another. The Irish and the English are an example of this.
Right.
The Serbs and the Croatians, the Czechs and the Slovaks. These people are very close to one another genetically and even in some ways culturally, but some things set them apart so that when they live together in the same system, they fight, and they want to separate. They want to have their own spaces.
So would you say that would it be fair to say that you are getting your understanding of race from science primarily, or is it something else, something more metaphysical?
I don't think it's scientific or metaphysical primarily. I think that race, first and foremost, is an observable phenomenon.
Sure.
We see racial differences, and that means that we are the kinds of beings that are capable of seeing racial differences. And science and metaphysics can help us understand that process, but what's most real and ineradicable is the process itself, the awareness of these differences that exist in the world, and the fact that we're equipped to be aware of these differences and the implications of that awareness. So I think that as we look more carefully and deliberately, scientifically, in other words, at our awareness of differences, we discover just how deeply ingrained this is, and how, in fact, it's ingrained into evolution long before human beings were ever close to appearing on this planet. So it has a pre-human evolutionary history. It's from our pre-human evolutionary heritage that we are aware of distinctions of kinds and the distinction between kin and non-kin, even within a larger group that we recognize as our own kind. Ants are not big-brained creatures, but their tiny little ant brains contain a little module that allows them to distinguish between kin and non-kin. And the evolutionary explanation for that, of course, is that genes seek to propagate themselves through time. And so that genes can propagate themselves through time, they seek out genetically similar partners as vehicles, basically, for the propagation of these genes over time. Now, there's this whole body of scientific knowledge of so-called genetic similarity theory, which is extremely powerful in explaining things we've already know and can observe. And Philippe Rushton, who is a friend of mine, now deceased, a psychologist, wrote Race, Evolution, and Behavior, did a lot of research on genetic similarity theory. One of the things that he did research on was the question, do opposites attract? We hear this, and the answer is no. Opposites don't attract. In fact, the basis of attraction is genetic similarity. And he even found that we somehow have modules in our brains that allow us to pair up with people who are genetically similar to us in ways that we are not even consciously aware. So one example he gave was things like histocompatibility. We actually will find and partner up with people who are histocompatible, that we're not allergic to, even though there's no conscious mechanism that we know of to produce that result. There are things in our brain that allow us to be aware of genetic similarities in other people that do not rise above the threshold of consciousness and that we don't even know how to explain yet. But when we look at the data, it's so powerful, it's so clear that there are patterns of affiliation between people based on genetic similarity that it's going to take generations of scientific study to finally unravel. But the phenomenon is really powerful. And what that, of course, explains is it explains families and politics. It explains why we have a stronger affiliation with our own kin than with our neighbors and with people who are very, very different, genetically speaking. It explains national and regional affiliations and so forth. So I think genetic similarity theory is very, very important in getting to the causes of things. But again, it all comes back to really explaining observable, categorizable, historical experiences that we all have. And therefore, the people who argue that race is a social construct and stuff like that, my answer to that is that no, race isn't a social construct. Race is a phenomenon that we all observe. And if things are socially constructed and if there are different theories that go along with our racial experience, trying to understand racial differences and so forth, those are attempts to come along after the fact and articulate and understand what we're already seeing. But what we're seeing is not socially constructed. What we're seeing is what nature provides us with. That's the given. The process of scientific understanding, I guess you could call it is a social institution, a social practice, but that comes later, and it doesn't in any way completely absorb race into attempts to interpret and understand the phenomenon of race.
So, but I mean, to say something is socially constructed, that doesn't necessarily imply that it's fake, right?
Well, no, it certainly doesn't. Society is a social construct and society is real.
Yeah.
But the reason why people want to argue that race is a social construct is they want to argue that it's mutable over time, that it can be changed, because people believe that we can change our minds. We can change our social constructions, and therefore social constructionism on race is basically a metaphysical presupposition of the egalitarian project. Because if we see that there are things that make people unequal, like race, IQ differences, sexual psychological differences, the differences between men and women, psychologically speaking, they think, well, these are social constructs, and as social constructs, they are mutable. They can be changed over time because we see social institutions and social constructs, languages and so forth, change over time. And that gives them the hope that these things can be altered. Altered in what way? Altered towards the norm of equality.
Wouldn't this divergent evolution that you mentioned previously, wouldn't that also imply mutability of race?
Yes, indeed. There is mutability on the genetic level. But race is not mutable in terms of the conventions that we use to talk about it. Now, the way that race can be mutated through conventions, and this is how culture feeds back into biology, is by instituting patterned reproduction, patterned breeding, eugenics or dysgenics. And every society institutes some kind of eugenic or dysgenic regime, whether they intend to or not. Every society, based on its institutions and its conventions, its values and so forth, will lead certain kinds of traits and certain kinds of people to be prized and reproduced more than other kinds of traits, other kinds of people. And therefore, culture does influence us on the genetic level through instituting basically selective breeding, whether it's dysgenic or eugenic.
The reason that I asked the original question about, you know, what is race and how you would define it is because, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of prominent white nationalists and I guess you'd say alt-right figures. And when I spoke to Richard Spencer specifically, he was very clear to me that his conception of race is not derived primarily or even secondarily from science. He actually, I remember very clearly, he spoke of race as a mystic might speak of God, if that makes any sense.
Well, what did he have to say?
Well, he said first of all that his conception of race was not drawing on science for it. And you know, he I don't have his actual words in front of me at the moment, but he almost defined it negatively, you know, like negative theology, sort of. He was talking about it in terms of what race is not. And he, you know, I guess he also kind of used some vague terminology, maybe, and maybe that I'm just misreading that as sort of mysticism. But
right.
But it was an interesting definition, and I think I mean, I'm seeing a lot of diversity actually on this very question among the white nationalists that I've spoken with.
Well, Richard Spencer has his own views about these things, and I can't really defend or attack them because they seem very vague to me. They seem sort of half-baked. And my view I would not characterize as being based on science, as I said. I think it's based on experience. I think it's based on observation, and that science is one of those things that comes along behind it and tries to explain what we're seeing and deepen our understanding of what's going on. Now, metaphysical concepts inevitably come into play as well. I, for instance, am a realist. I believe that there's an objective world and that there really are objective natural kinds. They're not eternal, as Aristotle or Plato thought that natural kinds were. They are mutable, but they do exist. And it's a defensible position that I adhere to, and it's a defensible metaphysical position about natural kinds. So the first thing is observation, experience, common sense, and then after that comes science and metaphysics to try and explain what we're seeing, deepen our understanding of what's going on, and also perhaps give rise to useful predictions and prescriptions about prudent behavior if you're constructing a better society, for instance, or a better business. What kinds of things can we do to make society more functional, more harmonious, more happy, given the nature of race and given the nature of genetic similarity, genetic ties, genetic enmities, and so forth that exist?
Well, there does seem to be, I've noticed, a sort of animosity towards scientific materialism on the white nationalist circuit. Am I misreading something?
There are people who have an animosity to scientific materialism within our sphere. I'm not one of those people. Ultimately, I'm a kind of materialist when it comes to science. Materialism is a metaphysical thesis that all that exists is matter in some sense. I wouldn't consider myself a materialist in that sense, but I consider myself a materialist in this sense, that a great deal of our understanding of the observable world around us is going to be in terms of cause and effect that exist in the material plane of existence. And to be somewhat dogmatically opposed to that and to say, well, there is a difference, a radical difference, a gulf between, say, man and nature, a radical difference between body and mind, a radical difference between culture and biology, I think is a kind of obscurantist metaphysical presupposition, usually connected with certain religious beliefs, that actually stands in the way of us understanding how things really work. For instance, there are a lot of people who have a strong conviction that there is something called freedom of the will. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. I think that people make choices, but I do not think that choices happen in accordance with what people call free will, whatever that means. The more I learn about genetics, the more I come to conclude that genetic determinism, which is a kind of materialism, genetic determinism, sure, is incredibly fine-grained. And there are ample studies done with twins, identical twins and fraternal twins, but the identical twins, of course, are the most exciting ones. People who are genetically identical and raised apart in sometimes very different households end up having similarities in their tastes, in their life courses, and even fine-grained similarities, like the kinds of cars that they drive, the kinds of careers that they have, the kinds of names they give their children, that are really kind of uncanny when you look at them. Because when I first started reading this, it was kind of chilling, because it's like, wow, things like your favorite color, you think, well, you know, there are things that are me, that are truly me. This is my identity. And things like my favorite foods and favorite colors, my tastes, the kinds of music I like, all of that is uniquely me. And it is uniquely you, because if you're the only one with that genome in existence, but if there's another person with the identical genome, lo and behold, they're going to like Mozart too. and the amount of similarity between people who are genetically identical is enormous, and it can't be explained by random luck, obviously. And so you also find that identical twins who live together and know one another, or even ones that meet when they're adults, they have an amazing rapport. They understand one another's thoughts. They can complete one another's sentences. There is a kind of harmony that exists between these people that's really remarkable. And for me, one of the great problems of politics is creating a harmonious society, a society where people feel at home, where they can, you know, understand one another, communicate with one another, work together, accomplish things, where they don't fight, where they don't feel alienated, and so forth. And the ideal society, in a way, the society that would be most harmonious, would be a society of identical twins. If we could all be cloned, right? You know, of course, there'd have to be the male clone set and the female clone set. And in the next generation, all the kids in that second generation would be as related to one another as brothers and sisters, and all the parents, all the people in the earlier generation, the older generation, would be as related to them as their own parents. That, it's a weird thought experiment, right? But
yeah,
that kind of society would be more harmonious just based on overwhelming genetic similarity than societies that are more genetically heterogeneous. Now, if that's the case, then we have a kind of model, a kind of platonic circle, ideal form, right, of the kind of group of people who can get along the best. Now, getting along isn't maybe the only social virtue, but it's certainly one of the things that most societies strive for. Even if people are unsociable, we want them to be unsociable in a social way, as Kant describes, you know, the Faustian strivings and things like that. We want all of that to be containable so that it doesn't ruin society. So that for me is an indication of why diversity is a bad idea. If the most harmonious relationships between people are the relationships of people who are genetically identical, then with each increase in genetic divergence, in genetic diversity, there's going to be less harmony, less understanding, more propensity to fight, less propensity to cooperate, to work together, to accomplish great things. And eventually, you're going to get so much diversity that there's simply no real society in the sense of anything that people have in common. The only thing that people might have in common in a maximally diverse society is they trade with one another or something like that. That might be the only thing they have in common. It would be a community of people who have nothing in common. And that's sort of what the marketplace is, and it's a least common denominator kind of way of people getting along. And even there, you've got to have common things like credit cards that work, a monetary system, stuff like that. So even there, you know, you've got to have some things in common. But I think that that's a rather dystopian picture of reality, because it's a world where without any kind of sense of belonging, it's a world without any ability to work together to create glorious things that are expressions of a particular people and their sense of destiny and identity. It's a world without a lot of things that we would recognize as high culture, adventure, progress, and so forth. So that's a dystopian view. So for me, the ethnostate idea is basically the idea of a society where people have enough genetic similarity to one another. They've got very strong genetic similarities, and they have a common language and a common culture, and therefore they can understand each other, communicate easily, work together, and so forth. And if you've got something like that, and we've had these things throughout history, we still have them in some places in the world today, they're worth keeping. They're worth keeping, and they're worth building upon, and we want to share that blessing, if you will, the blessing of harmony and genetic and cultural homogeneity with as many different groups as possible. And that's the whole project of ethno-nationalism. We want homelands for all distinct peoples. And once we create homelands for all distinct peoples and give them maximum autonomy to pursue life as they see fit, then we will see, I hope, peaceful divergent evolution in culture and even in race. And the world will be a beautiful place. It is kind of a Garden of Eden vision, right? Where you've got lots of different species of culture, lots of different types of people in their own places. And it might not be a world where there's complete peace, because there's always going to be stuff to fight about, but it's going to be a world without civil wars, we hope. And it's going to be a world without empire building and a lot of the causes of quarrel that exist today.
You don't think that there would be like an increase in warfare between states at that point?
I think that if we can create an ethos that recognizes the value of ethnic self-determination for all peoples, that is a better way of getting rid of warfare than the idea of trying to put everybody together under some kind of global government, which is sort of the idea that has been really pushed by these institutions like the League of Nations and the United Nations and all the globalist institutions, the European Union and so forth. They've, you know, explicitly said that if we have continental government in Europe, that'll end wars in Europe. If we have global government, that'll end global wars. I don't think that's true. I think that experience shows that the more distinct peoples that have to exist under common government, the more ethnic conflict there is, the more ethnic conflict and hatred there is. And really what you're talking about when you talk about global government is you're talking about some kind of imperial government. You're talking about empire. And it will inevitably be the case that some groups, because they have greater will to power, greater competence, if you will, in government and so forth, bureaucratic competence, whatever, they will, even if you try and have, you know, sort of a United Nations model with one of everybody, right, in the government, there's going to be a tendency over time for that global government or that continental government like the EU to take on an imperial cast, an imperial look, and it will have a ruling caste that will be ethnically homogeneous to some extent. And that is going to be the source of a great deal of conflict and hatred, unnecessary conflict and hatred. Right now, the European Union really is kind of a German empire. It's what Hitler almost created. They created it with the EU, because really Germany calls the shots pretty much in the EU. And a lot of countries don't like that. The French don't like this strange situation where they got into the EU thinking, well, they thought they were going to be calling the shots, to be quite honest. you know, and it's not a perfect solution. I think that ethno-nationalism, by giving every group its homeland and also by zealously guarding against the encroachment of one country on another, is really the way to go. And I think there would be a kind of ethno-nationalist world order. There would be a kind of United Nations in a way, but the United Nations would be there to help keep people separate and to help keep everything flowing along in the most amicable way possible. And also to deal with global problems, because there really are global problems. If sure. there were things like global warming, that would be a global problem. People dispute that. If there were global warming, I'd be all for having global solutions. One thing that's definitely a global problem is, well, Google the Shoemaker-Levy comet. It was a comet that hit the surface of Jupiter, and if it had hit the Earth, it would have been a extinction event. We wouldn't be talking here. So if the dinosaurs had a global government and global science and global defense against comets, we might not be having this conversation either. There might be lizards debating the virtue of the ethno-state rather than mammals. So,
you know, some would say that that's the case already.
Oh, yeah, the lizard people stuff. Yeah,
yes.
I find that very amusing. I do think that world peace is a great thing. I think that there will never be global government because there's always going to be differences between people. You know, the idea that we can live in a world without enemies doesn't really work because globalists have enemies too. They have enemies like me. Anybody with a bit of ethnic identity and pride is the enemy of the globalist regime. And since ethnic identity and pride will not cease unless there's basically just genocide against all group by mixing, right? That's not going to happen. And really the globalists tip their hand when they say, well, the future global citizen will be a homogeneous beige person. It's like, wait, isn't that tantamount to saying that diversity is a problem? Isn't that admitting that diversity is a problem and that if you're going to have global government, you're going to have a homogeneous global citizen? Well, that basically is a genocidal project against all the existing peoples of the world. And instead of declaring basically your intention to commit cultural and racial genocide against the whole planet in the name of peace, maybe we should just figure out how to make do with the existing cultural and racial differences that we've got today and how we can actually preserve our differences and live together. And I think the route forward to that is ethno-nationalism for everyone.
Well, there are, of course, there are many ways that you can divide humanity up. You could do it, for instance, you could do it by family if you were satisfied with these super small microstates, I guess. You could also do it geographically, by taste in music even, or by political affiliation. So my question to you is why race in particular? How, like, what benefits would you say that a sort of ethnic or racial arrangement provides over other ways of shaping society? Like, why are racial distinctions more salient than other sorts of distinctions?
Racial distinctions are more salient because they're more real. And that's the bottom line. There are people who say things like this, right? They say, I'm a Whovian, and I want to hang out with other Doctor Who fans. That's my identity. And I chuckle at that, and I'll say, look, that's not really your identity. That's just a fake identity that's been foisted upon you by capitalism, by entertainment business. And you want to declare this identity because you feel like no one's going to give you any flack about being a Whovian or a Trekkie or whatever. But you know you're going to get flack if you say that you're a proud American or a proud white person. And so for a lot of people, it's just a way of having tribes that are essentially fake and satisfying a need for identity that's deeply real with fake, politically correct, and non-threatening forms of identity. Non-threatening to whom? To the people who run our societies, basically. They love things like sports. You know, people rooting for their home team, right? Even if their home team consists of people who didn't grow up there, right?
Yeah.
They might be from other continents and so forth, but they still want to root for their home team. There's a desire for human beings to have real identity, and that's rooted in things that they don't choose. So it's rooted in your biology. It's rooted in the culture that you were born into. We don't choose that kind of stuff. It's rooted into what sex you have. It's rooted into class and other sorts of things that you don't choose and that affect you before you're ever self-conscious enough to choose them, right? You learn language before you're self-conscious and rational enough to ask yourself, gee, is this the language that I would have wanted to have learned? And all of that comes later. We have identities thrust upon us that are real. And race is the one that's most real because it's literally the warp and woof of our physical beings. The next thing on top of that, that's most important and closest to us, our second nature, race being our first nature, is culture, language, those conventions that we learn before we're self-conscious that are the foundation for any later conscious life and activities. All the quote-unquote free choices that we exercise and things like that, all of that comes much, much later after we have grown up in a particular culture. And those two things, racial identity, biological identity, and cultural identity, those things are real, and they can't be shrugged off. And the only choice we have vis-a-vis these things is to be real or fake, is to be authentic or inauthentic, to own up to what's been made of us, to, you know, who we are, or to flee that into essentially fake and superficial identities. And a lot of the identities that are passed around today as options really are just superficial and fake. And people aren't happy in this sort of existence. And that's really the great test, I think. You can't really be happy if you have a superficial, fake existence and you're not really being who you are or owning up to who you are. And so for me, racial identity and cultural identity are a matter of authenticity. It's a matter of being honest. It's a matter of being honorable, to own up to who you are and to be grateful for what's been given to you, to try and improve upon it, and to pass it on augmented to the next generation. That's sort of the whole ethical existential situation that I think that we're in. And I think that the ethics of liberalism and consumerism and constructing your identity and so forth, all of that kind of stuff is basically inauthentic hogwash. And it's no way to run a society. There are a lot of people I know who think that the best way to run a society is like a college, right? Or like a college team. So the college team, the college spelling bee team or whatever, or debate team, what do? Well, you try and find the best person for every team. Or if you've got a business, you try and find the best person for every slot within the business. And what happens in those sorts of enterprise associations is, yeah, you'll find that there is racial and ethnic diversity that's possible, right? Because there might be certain groups that aren't really good at software, but you can find one or two outliers for your software company. And so that gives a lot of people the illusion that diversity actually is a great model for society. And this is one of the great problems, I think, with liberalism and progressivism. Leo Strauss has an essay called Progress or Return. I believe it's in that essay. And one of the things that he deals with in that essay, and he deals with this elsewhere, is the foundation of the whole progressive conception of history. And basically the foundation of that is science. You look at how science works, and it's an enterprise where you can bring in people, doesn't matter what country you're from, as long as you can speak the language of math, right? And
yeah,
people can contribute to this collective, unfolding, progressive enterprise that goes on into the future and accumulates knowledge and power and so forth. The trouble is that's not really a model for society as a whole. The model for society as a whole cannot be a meritocratic enterprise. closer to the truth about how society should work is it's a family group. And just as in your family, you'd be considered a monster if you said, you know, little Johnny, I'm afraid I'm not going to put aside money for your college education because the neighbor kid is 2 standard deviations smarter than you are, and I'm going to contribute to his college fund instead. If you did that, you'd be a monster, right? The fact is that in a society that is based on ties of blood, you're going to have a bell curve, and you're going to have a few oddball outliers on either end. You're going to have a crazy maiden aunt or two. You're going to have someone who's a little slower than others, but they're your flesh and blood, and you want to take care of them. And so the enterprise association meritocratic model that comes out of business and science and academia is very, very tempting, and it's really the thing that sits in the back of the minds of a lot of people who believe that diversity can actually work. It can only work in Silicon Valley software industries where you're recruiting outliers from a lot of different groups in a highly meritocratic process. And face it, they're all subjected to a lot of totalitarian social engineering, as we now know from these Google lawsuits that are happening at Google leaks, to keep that all functioning together, because it's still fundamentally an unnatural form of association.
Well, with as much of an emphasis as you've been placing on biology so far, I want to ask you a bit of a hypothetical question. Given, let's say that society is most harmonious when it has, well, let's say your twin society is the sort of pinnacle of a harmonious society. Couldn't we further divide society up into, or by gender? And especially, you know, if we get 20, 30 years down the line and we've found out how to procreate via cloning. And then that way you can almost literally have something akin to that twin society that you described earlier. Would it not be then advantageous to divide society up by gender as well and leave the procreation to the cloning people?
Well, I think people would rebel against that, and because it's just fun to create children the old-fashioned way. And but you're right though. If there were people who wanted to go their own way, and you know Shulamith Firestone, who died a couple years ago, this radical feminist was actually talking about how technology can make it possible to have a society without men. And yeah, that's true. It can also make it possible to have a society without women. And yeah, there might be people, most of them homosexual of one sex or the other, who would be drawn to something like that. But it's a strange construct, I think, and it wouldn't really work because men like women and women like men. Every man today is born of a mother. He often has sisters, cousins. Yeah, there's conflict between the sexes because they are different, but they're also complementary. One of the reasons why I think people would even consider things like this is because in modern liberal society, there's such confusion about sex, biologically based sex roles. I don't even use the word gender. Gender is a term from grammar, right? There are no genders in this category. There's sex, and it's biologically determined. And we have a lot of people who are confused about these things. They're being confused because, well, they might be oddballs and outliers, biologically speaking, but we're also being fed a whole lot of nonsense about how many genders does Google have now, right? Or Facebook, you know, 256
yeah,
genders.
Facebook,
you know?
I think, yeah. I think it's over 50 at this point.
It's over 50. It's like going to Baskin Robbins, right? Well, that's nuts. That's really nutty. There's a lot of confusion. I think feminism has created a great deal of conflict, unnecessary conflict, and sexual liberation in general, not just feminism, has created a great deal of unnecessary and preventable conflict between men and women. People don't know how to relate to one another. There are all kinds of risks in relationships, and some people want to flee from that, and some will flee into these sorts of technological solutions like, you know, sex dolls or, God forbid, you know, cloning, you know, so you can just live with, you can reproduce without the opposite sex. But I think that's all an index of how messed up modern liberal society is. And the idea of the ethnostate, the idea of white nationalism, being that it is founded on trying to recover and protect the biological integrity of different racial and subracial groups, intrinsically has to be committed to a return to biologically based and also tradition hallowed sexual norms. And I think that once we just go back to that, and, you know, we have a little bit of tolerance for the outliers because we know about the bell curve and so forth, but if we can uphold the norms and uphold institutions that make it possible for people to just do what comes naturally, which is pair up and have kids, then I think the pressures that lead people to those kinds of radical sort of solutions will just sort of disappear.
Well, I want to run a thought experiment by you, because I was thinking of this the other day. This is what I do in my spare time. I'm sure you do it a lot as well. Just come up with thought experiments. But this one in particular struck me when I was thinking of it. So just bear with me for a second while I go through this. So imagine that we're in the year 2050. All the ethnostates have been established. So, you know, there's no more work to be done on that end. But then we find one day, while we're reading the newspaper, there is a brilliant and famous OBGYN who has just killed himself with a cyanide capsule in police custody. Now, the reason for this is he has been secretly growing African children in a laboratory and transplanting their brains into the bodies of healthy white newborns. So surgical techniques have become so advanced by this time that there are no scars from him doing all this. And by all appearances, nothing has actually happened to the white newborns. But the thing is, he's dead now, and he didn't keep any records of these activities and who was now carrying the brains of African newborns. So my question to you is, in this sort of situation, how would the authorities go about finding all of the living victims of his experiments? How would they identify them?
Well, I'm just salivating to say something outrageously racist, like, you know, put some funky music on and see how they react, or toss them a basketball or something like that. Well, you would find the likely victims, the population of possible victims, and you'd set them down and you'd give them a battery of tests. You would give them Raven's matrices and other IQ tests. You'd also give them the Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory. You could give them a whole range of standardized tests, and you would get a pretty good idea who has the African brains, because they would look, on average, like what we know African brains produce when they take these tests. So the IQs would be more like Africans. The levels of sociopathic behavior and personalities would be more like Africans. The levels of empathy or lack thereof would be more like Africans, and so forth. There are lots of objective measures that we've come up with that help us understand the different dimensions on which we can observe, if we have a lot of experience with peoples of different races, how different races differ from one another, exactly how, in terms of personality, in terms of abilities, and so forth. So yeah, it's definitely something that we could do.
Well, how would you distinguish between them and outliers, like you said?
Well, you would give them a battery of different tests, including IQ tests and also personality profile tests. And therefore, the chances of somebody being an outlier on, say, IQ tests, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and, you know, some other test you want to give, the chances of them being outliers on all three would be very, very low. Now, but here's the thing. I wouldn't be all that worried about it to begin with. Let's say I'm part of the Senate of an ethnostate, right? Mm-hmm. And I read about this in the newspaper. I'm not going to lose my shit. I mean, I'd be glad that the scientist has been stopped. I mean, this is like
right, yeah.
Dr. Mengele kind of stuff. What do they do with the white baby brains? You know, I mean, that's just pretty horrifying to think of. I would be glad if it's over, but it's like, well, geez, we might have a crime problem on our hands if we don't find these people. But even if you find them, what are you going to do? You're not going to kill them.
You could move them to their respective ethnostate.
Maybe. Yeah, something like that. What I would do is I'd just sort of keep an eye on these people, knowing that if they marry and have kids, the kids aren't going to have black genes in them anyway. And so it's just a problem that would eliminate itself. And it would be probably something I would just, if I were running a country and I heard about this thing, I'd probably try and keep it a secret. I'd like to find out who the victims are. And mm-hmm. It would be interesting to track them, you know, have their school test records and things like yeah. that kept track of. See, you know, see what their criminal records are, is stuff like that. See, you know, anything. Just follow their life courses. And chances are their life courses will be more similar to blacks than whites. But it's a problem that eliminates itself biologically with no trace if you just leave it alone. And my inclination is to think that's not really a terrible thing. My view about how to get to a white ethnostate is mm-hmm. very, very slow and steady and patient. If we had the right government by the right principles, time would be on our side. My attitude is for people who are of different racial groups, who are old and retired, I don't care. I mean, my attitude towards them is let them just live out their lives in retirement. There's a biological solution to that. What I would like to do, though, for the younger ones that, you know, would be having kids and so forth, is to create incentives for them to pursue their lives elsewhere. Over time, what would happen is you would slowly, by simply instituting pro-white incentives, create a homogeneously white society. I think that's yeah. preferable because it respects human rights. I mean, I do believe that all people have some rights. I believe in animal rights. So I have to believe in human rights, even the human rights of other groups, even groups that I consider incompatible with a healthy white society. I still believe they've got human rights, that they, you know, I feel sympathy for them. I respect them as living beings and so on and so forth. I don't want to harm a hair on their heads, but I do want to create institutions and incentives that over time will slowly create homogeneously white societies and do it without war and chaos and bloodshed and catastrophes and the kind of race war stuff that, you know, you find in William Pierce and Harold sure. Covington novels. I think that's completely unnecessary. And frankly, it just scares the normies. And we want to get mm-hmm. as many people on board with the idea that this is something that's not only good in theory, but it's also something that can be accomplished with a minimum amount of unpleasantness and, in fact, is actually a way of saving ourselves from a great deal of unpleasantness because the current path that we're on is not going to end well. And therefore, the sooner we get off that path towards something that in the long term is going to be sustainable and respect the differences and the rights of all the different peoples of the world, the better.
Well, my next question concerns a subject that you've written a bit less about, but It really caught my eye, especially when I was reading Old Right versus New Right. So in Old Right versus New Right, you say at one point that we want to free ourselves of both Jews and Muslims. And the reason I'm curious about this is because, well, I mean, let us assume for a moment that Judaism is an ethnicity, at least in part. But what about Islam? Like, one can be a white Muslim. You know, there's nothing logically impossible about a Dutch Muslim or a Belgian Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. So my question would be, on what grounds would a white ethnostate prohibit the practice of Islam? And equally importantly, is how would it do so?
Well, the reason why I think Islam is a problem is that Islam is an inherently political religion. It promulgates a new regime, a new order of society. It's a law code. And as such, therefore, when it exists in a white society or in the proximity of a white society, it basically is on a collision course. It has to replace that society with its law code, its institutions, which are ultimately institutions created in Arabia a very long time ago. And therefore, the people who carry this mimetic virus, which I consider Islam to be, might be white, but they're like plague rats. They're carrying a mimetic plague that will destroy white societies and create societies that are foreign to and unpleasant for white people. And therefore, they can't be permitted. Now, what would I do with people who decide to become Muslims? Well, first of all, I would have to make some distinctions here. There are some people sure. who become Muslims because, well, they are interested in religion and philosophy and mysticism, and they think, oh, I'll be a Sufi or whatever. They're practically not real Muslims anyway, because I don't even think Sufism is real Islam. Sufis are Greco-Roman pagans who took on Islamic garb in the Islamic Dark Ages because it was the only way they could survive. And so things like that I'm kind of okay with, I suppose. But generally what I would say to people who believe in Islam is that, oh, you have joined the Islamic community. You've joined the Ummah. There is an Islamic world, and we urge you to live according to Islamic law in the Islamic world. And I would give them even first class passage to the Islamic country of their choice. And I think that some of them would take me up on that, but most wouldn't. And I think that, in the present day society, people convert to Islam out of all kinds of reasons. For one, it's just a manifestation of the alienation and rootlessness, artificially created rootlessness of modern liberal society. Just like there are lots of people who are attracted to Asian thought or to mm-hmm. Japanese culture. Why do they love Japanese culture? Well, it's so integral. It's so exotic. It's exotic because it's integral, and there's no reason why more integral Western societies that are proud of themselves wouldn't be as satisfying to these weebs as Japan is today. They want to flee a rootless, fake society into things that seem more authentic. Of course, to do so is in itself inauthentic. But that's one of the conditions that we have. I think that the desire of people to become Muslims would disappear if we had healthier white identity and societies that were founded on that. But if people choose to become Muslims, I would say yes, first class tickets to the Ummah. We'll send all your property with you. Goodbye. You realize, of course, that they'll kill you if you try and become an apostate and want to return, right, and so on and so forth. It's sort of a one-way trip. You know, the roaches check in, but they don't check out. And I feel sorry for them. But I think, honestly, that if we drain the swamp of liberal rootlessness and fakery, that there will be a lot less of that kind of stuff going on.
You consider yourself a Heideggerian, right?
Yeah, in many ways. Yeah.
Just actually, while I've got that thought in mind, what did you think of, what do you think of Dugin's take on Heidegger? I know you're not generally a fan of him, but...
I wrote a review of the Dugin book on Heidegger. I didn't think much of it. A lot of it struck me as maximally metaphysical misreadings of Heidegger, which is not, you know, an uncommon thing. And of course, the stuff that he picks out in Heidegger that is the stuff that's most consistent with his own kind of messianic Russian nationalism. And that's the kind of stuff that I find least appealing about Heidegger. So I'm just not crazy about his book on Heidegger, to be quite honest. I do think that when he talks about, when he uses the concept of Dasein, when he talks about the fourth political theory, I mean, he's consistent with what Heidegger is talking about, and it's consistent with Heidegger's critique of National Socialism, because Heidegger believed that the primary form of identity that he wanted to defend, that made him a German, was not simply reducible to race. And he thought that the people in the National Socialist movement who made too much of race were actually mistaking a necessary condition of German identity for a sufficient condition of German identity. And that by overestimating the importance of race in ethnic identity, what they were laying the groundwork for was destroying German identity. And indeed, as soon as the Germans started marching around Europe and getting their calipers out and looking at the skulls of the Czechs and people like that, they started thinking, gee, there are lots of really attractive Czechs. We'll just breed with them and make them one with our race. You know, they talk that way about the Poles. The best of the Polish population will be assimilated into Germany. It's like, what a nightmare, because that really does show you that what was essential for them was race, and that they just thought, well, we'll just assimilate different racial elements into speaking German. And for Heidegger, I think that was creepy, because, and he actually uses this language, it's mistaking a necessary condition for a sufficient one. There's more to being German than being white. And when you start putting whiteness as a very important category, you start thinking, well, we can just, you know, assimilate lots of different people into the German population. But the trouble is that destroys their ethnicity, and it also really destroys the German ethnicity as well. It would change the Germans just as it would change the Czechs and change the Ukrainians and create some kind of new, not beige, homogeneous beige man, but the homogeneous blonde man, I suppose. And Heidegger wasn't too happy with that kind of vision. He wanted the different peoples of Europe to maintain their differences and to figure out a way of differing peacefully with one another. And that, I think, is totally consistent with the New Right, as I conceive it, and ethno-nationalism as I conceive it. And to some extent, I think that Dugin is right to talk about Dasein as opposed to race, because for Heidegger, Dasein is, you know, biologically German Dasein is white, but it's not in, it's different from Czech Dasein and
right.
Danish Dasein. Even though they're very similar genetically, it's different because it's a different language and a different culture and therefore a different world in a sense, a different network of significance, a different outlook onto the common universe that we all share. And that's something worth preserving. That's at the core of identitarian politics. And so it's definitely worth preserving.
Why, you know, in my reading, I still haven't been able to really figure out why Dugin has legs among many on the alt-right or among white nationalists. Do you have any theories as to why that's the case?
Gee, no, I've read a couple of his books. I'm not all that impressed. Okay, put it this way. I think that if I sat down with him and had dinner with him and talked about ideas, he would be a very engaging and interesting person to talk to because he reads widely, and we could talk about Heidegger and we could talk about Bataille maybe and so forth. We could talk about Guénon and Evola and Alain de Benoist. We've read a lot of books. The same books. We might really end up being fast friends. I don't know. He's an admirable person, an interesting person. I want there to be more people who can traverse this literature and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
However, I really think that so much of what he does is just hinged upon creating apologetics for a kind of Russian imperial revanchism that I can't be sympathetic to as an ethno-nationalist.
Yeah, you pretty much stole the words out of my mouth with that one. And that's why it's so weird to me, I guess, to see this phenomenon amongst white nationalists. But maybe it's confined to just the few people who I've spoken about this with.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a small thing in the English-speaking world. I don't think that he has a lot of followers in the English-speaking world. I think there are a lot of people who are curious about him, and I admire people who are curious about him, and I hope that his books continue to be read and translated. It's certainly infinitely superior to the shelves groaning with books of Foucault and Derrida and all this stuff. Yeah, so I wish the guy well. He's a learned guy, but I think that at his heart, he is opposed to ethno-nationalism, and he's for Russian imperialism, and I'm not for that. I sympathize with the Estonians and the Latvians and the Lithuanians and the Ukrainians, and I think that Russia itself would be better off if it gave up this deep-seated mentality that's so similar in many ways to the mentality of Americans, but much more deep-seated, which is this kind of messianic nationalism that they have, this sense of messianic destiny. And the trouble with that is that it is an engine of miscegenation and destruction of their own identity. There's some material at Countercurrents. One of my writers, I can't think of his name now. He's a Polish writer, and he's reported on this book by this Russian nationalist who talks about how Russia became a machine, not a nation. Russia is a machine. The Russian Empire is a machine, and there's a Russian imperial mentality that goes along with that. And the trouble is that the system, the machine, liquidates the people. And this is true of Rome, it's true of Byzantium, and it's true of the Third Rome as well. Rome became a machine that liquidated the founding population of Rome and kept bringing in new peoples and liquidating them and created a kind of empire and a kind of imperial man, but it did so at the expense of destroying the distinct groups that founded it. Byzantium did the same thing. By the 8th century or so, there were no more Romans in Byzantium. They had been replaced by people from all over the empire, Slavs and Armenians and people from Asia Minor and so forth. It destroyed its own founding stock. And the Third Empire, the Third Rome, does the same thing. The first non-white to rule Russia was Boris Godunov. He was mostly Tatar in his background. And this was at the beginning of the 17th century, the end of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century. The machine, the imperial machine, to augment its power, this started with Ivan III and Ivan IV, basically treated anybody who swore allegiance to the Tsar in Moscow, spoke the Russian language, and followed the Orthodox Church as a Russian. And in order to shore itself up, it created all these Tatar nobles, right? They were de facto very powerful people after the Golden Horde collapsed basically after the great standoff with Ivan III and the Golden Horde, and it collapsed. All of these Tatars were there. They were powerful. They had lands, and so they were simply integrated into Russia. And this is how modern Muscovy came about. It was a machine basically that melded together two things. It melded together Byzantium, and it melded together Mongol despotism, Oriental despotism. And it's been profoundly destructive of the ethnic genetic interests of anybody who's fallen into its clutches. Now, that doesn't mean that these, you know, Nazi ideas that, the Russians are just miscegenated with Mongols and stuff like that, that kind of stuff, yeah, is all true. It's partly true. It's definitely partly true. But it doesn't, you know, that kind of thing, that kind of dismissiveness is crude and dumb. But it has been very, very destructive of the ethnic differences of the various peoples in that empire. And today, the way Putin runs things, you know, Moscow has a giant mosque. He thinks that having all these Muslims in the Caucasus, you know, under his control makes Russia more powerful. If you are critical of Muslims, you know, you're frowned upon in Russia. So to keep the powerful big Russian machine going, as Putin conceives it, he's willing to tamp down on the ethnocentrism of the native Russian population. That's not a good system. It's similar to the system we have in America today, where we're ruled by people who are opposed to the ethnic interests, the ethnic genetic interests of the founding stock of the country. And eventually we got a non-white ruler. Obama came a long time later than what happened in Russia with Boris Godunov.
Mm-hmm. So you previously, and across many writings, voiced a partiality to certain forms of pluralism, religious pluralism being one of them. And in the very introduction to Old Right, New Right, you go so far as to say that you, and I'm quoting you here, see the North American New Right as an inherently pluralistic movement. Now, of course, when I read that, the philosopher in me starts scratching his head, because I'm thinking, well, why is pluralism vis-a-vis religion or pluralistic approaches to right-wing politics desirable, while pluralism vis-a-vis race and ethnicity is undesirable? So what's basically my question is, what is the philosophically relevant factor that makes the question of race categorically different to other distinctions?
Well, when I talk about pluralism there, mm-hmm, really what I'm saying is this. There are many different systems of thought and axioms and starting points that lead people to conclude that something like ethnic nationalism is a good thing. So we have people in our midst who are scientific materialists, and we have people who are very metaphysical, people who are into traditionalism and things like that, which is a mm-hmm metaphysical system of ideas. We have people with different religious outlooks, Christians, atheists, agnostics, people who are into mystical traditions from the East and so forth. I know lots of people who are into Hinduism. People who are interested in Taoism and stuff like that, people who are into European paganism. Those are the kind, there's an inherent pluralism in religious thought as well that I think is consistent with white ethno-nationalism. There's some religions that aren't consistent with that, right? And so I want to respect that range of permissible, if you will, pluralism that still leads to the kinds of conclusions that we're driving towards in this movement, the North American New Right. However, I do recognize, I do also have my own views on these matters. And sure, one of the things that is going to happen in the next few years is I'm going to set out my own sort of if you will, system. Because as Blake said, if you don't create your own system, you become a slave to another man's. And I do have, if you will, a system of ideas that I have worked out over time studying philosophy. And I want to put it out there. You know, people can take it or leave
that's
it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, people are going to
when
take it.
When do you think we can expect that?
Well, this spring I'm going to put out my little book, The White Nationalist Manifesto. Also in the spring, I'm putting out a piece called, I'm calling it right now, A Philosophical Agenda, which is sort of a system program, like something you'd find in German idealism, right? And then after that, I'm going to work on a couple of books. One is going to be a book called Identity Politics, and it's going to be the foundations of identity politics, sort of, if you will, metaphysical and epistemological and anthropological, philosophical, anthropological foundations of identity politics. And another book is going to be a book of political philosophy that outlines what I think is a defensible form of political philosophy that would be very, very good for an ethnostate. There's going to be a lot of different, there are going to be a lot of different regimes, I think, in ethnostates, because if you look at the history of Europe, well, there have been homogeneous, more or less, you know, racially homogeneous and more or less culturally homogeneous white societies for thousands of years that have had radically different forms of government. So there's a certain pluralism that we have to accept about that too. But there's something that I want to defend. There's certain political principles that I think are defensible. And the reason why I want to put that out there is, well, I want to put my cards on the table. These are my views. If they're defensible, I'd like to see them prevail. If they can be improved upon, I want to know where the flaws are and so forth. But also, I think one of the reasons why our movement, broadly speaking, white nationalism, the new right in America and so forth, hasn't really gelled into creating institutions that are as impressive as, say, the institutions in the libertarian movement, is that the libertarians have doctrines, right? They put out big books, you know, so if you want to look at the big canonical works of Austrian economics, they can show you a shelf of these things, or objectivism. Objectivism is a system of ideas. I don't think it really hangs together as a system of ideas, but the very fact that it puts itself forward as a system of ideas that you can, that will allow you to lead a certain kind of life, that's sort of treated as cut and dried by a lot of people, and they glom onto it. And when they glom onto it, they create institutions that propagate that view. And I think that we really need people to step forward and say, here's a system. Here's a system of ideas. Here's a doctrine. And read it. Tell me what you think of it. And if you want to sign off on this, we can start then figuring out ways of propagating it better. So at that point, the movement is still going to be pluralistic, but I'm going to be playing a stronger role, taking my own side in my own particular views than I do now. And of course, I'm still going to be publishing people who disagree with me, because I think that's, you know, part of creating an exciting intellectual movement is creating platforms where there are lots of, there's intellectual diversity. Not everything has to be marching in lockstep in the same direction. A lot of intellectual movements is more like whirling around on the dance floor together for fun. You know, it doesn't go in a particular direction sometimes. It's just circling around, but it's fun and people want to join the dance. And I want this to be incredibly fun and stimulating. I want this to be what the left used to be generations now ago, something exciting and stimulating. It's not that way anymore. It's a bunch of po-faced, doer, blue-haired crazies. There's just no fun. You're afraid to disagree with these people. You're afraid to think. I want the new right in America to be, first and foremost, incredibly intellectually exciting. And second, I also want to be putting my views out there and defending them as mine, and seeing if things will gel around that that might help create political and historical change.
This is what I like to consider my fun question. Because it's fun for me, and it's been fun for everyone else I've given it to. If you could have every leftist, if you could force every leftist to read just 5 books and reckon with the arguments therein, what 5 would you choose?
Well, that's a really good question. And someday I hope that I can list 5 books of my own for this. But in terms of things that I think would be really good for leftists to grapple with, first would be Jared Taylor's White Identity. The second would be Philippe Rushton's Race, Evolution, and Behavior. The third would be probably one of Richard Lynn's books, like IQ and Global Inequality. One of the books that where he talks about just the effects of IQ differences in terms of a whole host of social outcomes that might be desirable.
He's an Irish guy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So Richard Lynn, so that would be 3. A fourth book definitely would be Kevin MacDonald's The Culture of Critique.
Yeah.
And maybe a book that would be something that we could stick in there before people actually read The Culture of Critique would be Israel Shahak's book, Jewish History, Jewish Religion, which is a very short book written by a Jewish dissident that once you read that, it's something you can read in a sitting, a single sitting, I think would really prime a lot of people to read Kevin MacDonald's The Culture of Critique. And I'm specifically thinking these are going to be somewhat intellectual leftists. And
sure, yes.
So
yeah.
If they were anything like me in their exposure to certain Jewish intellectual movements, I think that they are going to have some questions and puzzles that they have set aside for future reflection that will be very powerfully solved by reading somebody like Kevin MacDonald, and they're going to be coloring themselves, you know, minds blown. Those would be the 5. Jared Taylor's White Identity, Race, Evolution, and Behavior, Lynn, say, IQ and Global Inequality, the Shahak book, Jewish History.
How do you
Jewish
spell
religion.
His last name? Because I have not heard of that one.
It's Shahak, Jewish History, Jewish Religion, and then The Culture of Critique. Those things, I think, would be quite mind-blowing, and if people actually grappled with those, I think a lot of them would have to start changing their political paradigm. And then the next book they would read would be my White Nationalist Manifesto. That would be number 6.
You can keep going, you know. You don't have to confine yourself to just 5.
Yeah, but 5 is good, because if you give people a list of 10 books, I mean, the chances of people reading 10 books as opposed to 5, they're radically different chances.
All right. Well, that's all I've got, Greg, for now. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, this has been pretty pleasant and enjoyable. So yeah, let's leave it at this for now, and we can continue the conversation in the future. I'd be happy to.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've certainly enjoyed it. It's been very illuminating.